Well, good morning, everyone. Good to see a lot more of you here. Had some pretty scarce services the last couple times, and good to see a little bit fuller benches. It's amazing. It's always amazing to me how God fits stuff together, especially subjects. A lot of times I've noticed that Sunday school goes pretty well with the sermon, and that's going to be the case this morning. We'll dig into why that is a little bit later. For those of you that haven't been here in a while or aren't aware of it, we've been working through a series I'm calling The Story, or The Big Story, and it's looking at God's story of redemption. We started with Abraham and how God called him, and we've made it all the way with the Israelites coming into Canaan and settling into the Promised Land. The problem is, making it to the Promised Land didn't fix the big problem that we've seen all along in this whole story, and that is the problem of sinful hearts. And we've seen that every time good things happen to the children of Israel, they worship God for a while, but they always fall back into sin, either idol worship or just following the gods that are around them. And last time we looked at the first couple chapters of Judges, which kind of just takes us straight into depression mode again. Like, we kind of hit a high crossing the Jordan, and the people actually follow God for a while there. And they're faithful, they do exactly what God tells them to do until they get into Canaan. And we saw last time that it was only a matter of a little while there that they stopped following what God told them to do. They were supposed to go and drive all the people out of Canaan, and instead they turn them into slaves, some of them. They're like, well, why destroy these people when we can make them work for us? And so they turn them into slaves. Well, within only a generation or two, those slaves revolt and turn the Israelites into slaves, and then they're the ones being oppressed. Anyway, we saw that how this is a very powerful description and a metaphor for sin, and how that if sin is not removed, it will take over. It will always take over, just like it did for the Israelites. And really, the whole book of Judges follows this same theme. Now, there's the pattern we see kind of over and over is that the people sin and worship idols and do whatever they feel like doing. Then they get oppressed because they didn't drive out the people that they were supposed to drive out to start with. Those people oppressed them. God will raise up someone, either a man or, in one case, a woman, Deborah, to knock down some idols, get rid of, you know, the idol worship, at least in their area, and free them from the oppression of the people that are oppressing them. And for a while, maybe the people will worship God again, but it's only a short time usually that they fall right back into it and are right back where they were. So it's just kind of the cycle that we see over and over. And with that being said, there's some amazing stories in Judges, and I was planning to dig into them, some of them being Deborah and Gideon and Samson. Those are all found there in Judges. And there's some high points in there, but there's also some really sad, depressing stories too. There's one where they have to go destroy the tribe of Benjamin, and there's 65,000 men get killed from both sides in one war, which I think it's a little bit hard to tell, but it seems like it only lasted about a week or so. That's a lot of people being killed. And I thought I would dig into some of those stories, especially some of the bigger ones, you know, Deborah, Gideon, and Samson. But I don't know, as I kept looking at it, and I spent way too much time yesterday trying to figure out what I was actually going to do, and it just, nothing really felt like it was what I wanted to do, partly because we've looked at this theme so often, the idea of what sin is, how it can take over, and I'm not saying that we couldn't have gotten some really good stuff out of that. Every time I dig into any kind of story, I realize there's more there than what you think. But I think we're actually going to kind of jump right through Judges. There's a phrase that I think kind of sums it up. It's actually the very the very last line of Judges, if you want to kind of get a picture of what the whole book of Judges is, it goes like this: and the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of, well, sorry, that's actually a phrase that you see over and over in Judges, but the very last line, it says, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And that's how the book of Judges ends. There's no promise of anything better and no hope for the future. It's just they did what was evil, and there was everyone was doing what was right in their own eyes. What's interesting is that the very next book is in the Bible is the book of Ruth. And Ruth is in really stark contrast to Judges. It's a story of people being faithful and keeping promises. Boaz is the redeemer, and he takes a bad situation and turns it into something good. And through that, it actually, Jesus comes through that line, that lineage of Boaz and Ruth there. And that story is actually set during this time, during the Judges, the period of the Judges, when people were not keeping their promises to God or to each other. And so that story kind of provides a relief against what was actually going on as far as the whole country goes. And it brings promise of a hope and points forward to another Redeemer that was going to come, that being Jesus. However, what's interesting is that the Tanakh, which is, I guess, the Hebrew Bible, does not have Ruth after the book of Judges. And it never did, as I understand it. It's actually the book of Samuel that comes right after Judges, if you look at how, I guess, the original Hebrew Bible was written. Ruth is actually placed kind of in the poetic section. I think it's after Song of Solomon. And even that is in different order. I think, how does it go for us? Song of Solomon, then Isaiah next? I think with them it's Song of Solomon, then Ruth, and then Malachi, I think. Anyway, so if you think about that, it actually kind of makes a lot more sense, because Judges, and then we go straight into Samuel. And the two are very much connected. It's actually Samuel himself that wrote both of these books as we understand it. And so there's a continual flow. There should be a continual flow between those two. And it makes a lot of sense if you read it that way. I'm not saying there's some very good case for why Ruth is where it is. For one thing, it kind of lines up with the timeline there. And it does provide hope right after a very sad and dark book. It provides that future of looking forward to a Redeemer coming. So there's still some debate about whether that's the best place to put it in the order, but I think there's some very good cases for why it's there. So I'm not trying to say that the order that it's in is not a good one. Just to say that when we think about that, if we go straight from Judges into Samuel, the whole thing, it makes a lot of sense looking at it like that. Anyway, so all that being said, we're going to kind of skip right over Judges, and partly because of what I already said, partly because I kind of want to finish up the series before I finish up here on Earth, and I might better hurry up if that's the case. So, 1 Samuel. The book of 1 Samuel has a very neat structure. If you want to turn to it, maybe to start with, obviously we have 1 and 2 Samuel. Those were actually just one book originally. They weren't split into two. The reason I think we do have it split into two here is because it was two separate scrolls, but it was written as one continuous story. So the structure of Samuel makes sense if you look at 1 and 2 as one book. It opens with the story of Hannah and how she could not have a child, and then how God gives her a son, that being Samuel, who she then gives back to God. And it includes this amazing poem that Hannah prays or writes. Somebody wrote it anyway. And this poem is actually kind of the key to the whole book. You know, often when I'm reading through Scripture and I come across a prayer like that or a poem, and one thing that's actually helped is looking at it in a translation that actually breaks it into the poem structure. I think most of the time the King James doesn't do that. It's just one continuous line. If you actually look at it as a poem, you know, with verses and stuff, it kind of helps you to visualize it. But anyway, often when I come to that part, I tend to skip over it fast because it's like, well, I want to get on with the rest of what's going on here. They're singing their song or doing their poem or whatever. But in this case, it's actually kind of the key to the whole book. And we'll look at that specifically a little bit more later. But the themes of this poem are, there's kind of three themes in it. And Trenton, if you want to throw up that slide there, I just made a single slide so we can kind of keep it in front of us as we look at this. But first one is, God opposes the proud and exalts the humble. And I think this is actually, if you want to pick out one from this whole, or from this list, this is the most important theme and the biggest one for the whole book. God opposes the proud and exalts the humble. Two, being, despite human evil, God is still at work. And three, God will eventually raise up a messianic king that will fix everything. And this poem and the points in the poem summarize kind of the whole book of Samuel. And we're supposed to think about these points as we read it. So we're just going to leave those points up as we continue on here. As far as the structure of Samuel, it's kind of it kind of revolves around three main characters. The first, I think it's 1 through 7, chapters 1 through 7, are focused on Samuel and his work. And God uses Samuel. It starts with him as a baby and then as a young boy, and we won't get into him too much this morning, but you know, God uses him to warn Eli about his sons, and then through Samuel, God lets Eli know that him and his sons are going to be replaced as the spiritual leaders of Israel. And again, we see the theme, well, right away, I guess, in the very first section there, we see the theme of God bringing down the proud and exalting the humble in that account. The proud being, especially, maybe not so much Eli, but especially his sons, were majorly abusing their power and thought they could get away with whatever they wanted to. God brings them down, destroys them, removes Eli as the spiritual leader of Israel, and in his place brings up, a young boy, that being Samuel, as the one that God would use to lead the children of Israel. So right away we see that theme come across in the very first section there of Samuel. Second main character we have is Saul. A number of years ago, we did a Bible study with the youth on the life of Saul. And of all the studies that we did as a youth group, I think that one has probably stuck with me about the most. I would say it's probably the one that stuck out with me the most. There's so many interesting things about Saul that are a warning to us and also a comfort. And we'll dig into that once we get to it. But there's so many interesting things. Saul is quite an impressive guy. He's tall and good looking, and it seems like people like him. And yet he's also extremely shy as a young man. He's so shy, in fact, that when Samuel gets all the tribes together to make it official and to present Saul as the king, Saul goes and hides in the luggage, and they can't find him. They're like praying to God and asking him to, like, what are we missing here? Where did he go? We can't find him anywhere. And God actually tells Samuel, and it kind of uses the plural, so I'm assuming there were like men with Saul that were kind of helping him. But God specifically tells them in their prayer that Saul is hiding in the baggage. So they go and look for him. Sure enough, there he is, and they bring him out, and then they make him king. But so that's what we see first. Like, Saul is this super shy guy, even though he's, says that he's tall and good looking and all that. It's like, how is this guy going to be king if that's what he's like? Well, then just a little bit later, we see him doing some amazing stuff. The Spirit of God comes on him. God empowers him to do stuff that he could never have done on his own. He wins a bunch of battles. But we also see a bunch of character flaws, and we'll, you know, obviously we know what happens. He ends up descending into madness and trying to kill David because of jealousy. So again, thinking about our themes, the most powerful person in Israel ends up killing himself in the end, committing suicide to avoid being captured by the Philistines. So again, God shows that theme of God will bring down the proud and raise up the lowly, and the lowly being David in this case, the one who was hunted and chased around, ends up becoming the one that replaces Saul. And then that brings us to, and Saul and David kind of overlap in this, you know, book. If you want to look at it, it's kind of an arc. Saul kind of comes up and then starts descending, and while Saul is descending, David is ascending. He's winning battles, and God is using him. And you know, once Saul's off the picture, then it's on to David. And he's kind of the opposite in a sense of Saul as far as how he becomes king. He's kind of the least likely to become king of Israel. He's that kind of strange kid that sings to his sheep and writes poetry, is how he's described. And I can imagine him probably being the one that's voted the most likely to be in his parents' basement at 40. He doesn't seem to have much of a future. He's just the guy out watching sheep. And you see that when he goes to take food to his brothers, they're like, what in the world are you doing here? Like, get out of here. And yet God uses him to become the greatest king, maybe arguably that ever was, but for sure that ever was in Israel. And he was a humble man who loved God with all his heart, but even he messes up. And we know the stories of his failures. And I think it's interesting, especially thinking about how the book of Samuel does not sugarcoat that. It doesn't try to cover up or justify what David did. It just is very clear that he sinned. And actually, even though David repented of that, and he repented when he was confronted by it, the consequences of David's sin end up really leading to the breaking up of David's family and eventually the kind of the destruction of all of Israel, the splitting of the kingdoms into two then. So even in that, although I think God very much blessed David and his king or his rule, we still see the consequences of sin in that. And I think it points to those, or points one and two, that even during the dark times of David's life, God was still working, and then especially pointing forward to point three, and that being that God will eventually send a perfect king. Even David couldn't get it all right and messed up. So those are kind of the, and then the book of Samuel ends with kind of an epilogue, which is a summarizing of the whole book again. So if you want to look at how it's structured, that's kind of the themes. You've got Samuel, and then Saul, David, and then kind of an ending that summarizes the whole thing. And I know that was kind of a lot of time to summarize a book, but I think it really helped me to understand what it's about. And so I'd like to spend quite a bit of time in Samuel, and then there'll probably be overlap with Kings, since that's sort of a retelling of some of the same things. But for the rest of today, I'd like to just go back and look at the story of Hannah, and I'm sure we can't really do it justice with another 20 minutes or so, but again, I think it's important that we look at this story to understand the rest of the book. So I mentioned, let's just read verses 1 and 2, and we'll dig into that story a little bit. So Samuel, 1 Samuel 1, verse 1, it says, "There was a certain man of Ramathaim Zophim, of the hill country of Ephraim, whose name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, son of Elihu, son of Tohu, son of Zoph, an Ephrathite. Man, I should have practiced these. He had two wives. The name of the one was Hannah, and the other Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. So the first thing we see here is that Elkanah had two wives, and this is a problem. Polygamy is something that had been going on for a long time at this point, and there's actually a number of main characters in the Old Testament that had more than one wife. Elkanah is portrayed as at least a somewhat godly man, as we'll see a little bit later here. But I think it's really important that we make sure we understand that that was not God's plan, and it never was. Now, I didn't dig into this real deep. I'm sure we could dig into how and why God allowed that in some cases to start with. But I couldn't really think of a single case in the Bible where that was specifically mentioned, that a man had more than one wife, where that resulted in something good. Think about the stories where that's specifically mentioned. just a couple examples: Abraham and Samson, even David and Solomon. And each of those, there's grief that happens from it. There's always problems that come out of it. So it definitely wasn't God's plan. And I've noticed actually that there's kind of an acceptance of this idea, at least in our culture, again. It's not called polygamy. I think it's called polyamory, something like that. It's not necessarily a marriage relationship, but at least three that kind of agree to have a relationship that, it's weird, but I keep noticing it pop up. They even have their own flag. And I don't, obviously this is not something we're dealing with ourselves, but let's just never forget that this was not God's plan. And crazy stuff is going to come out of it if we start accepting that. Anyway, the fact that Hannah is mentioned first there in verse 2 would indicate that Hannah was probably Elkanah's first wife. And it seems like maybe we can assume that because Hannah couldn't have children, Elkanah gets a second wife so that he could have children. Just continuing on, I'll just read verses 3 through 8. It says, "Year after year, this man went up from his town to worship and sacrifice to the Lord Almighty at Shiloh, where Hophni and Phinehas, the two sons of Eli, were priests of the Lord. Whenever the day came for Elkanah to sacrifice, he would give portions of the meat to his wife Peninnah and to her sons and daughters. But to Hannah he gave a double portion because he loved her and the Lord had closed her womb. Because the Lord had closed Hannah's womb, her rival kept provoking her in order to irritate her. This went on year after year. Whenever Hannah went up to the house of the Lord, her rival provoked her till she wept and would not eat. Her husband Elkanah would say to her, 'Hannah, why are you weeping? Why don't you eat? Why are you downhearted? Don't I mean more to you than 10 sons? So we're told here that Elkanah came to worship God and offer sacrifice every year. And this is something that all of Israel was supposed to be doing. They were supposed to come to Shiloh every year to do this. But if you remember the time frame here, we go straight from Judges into Samuel, that was not happening as far as the whole country goes. It was a time when people worshipped whatever gods they felt like and whatever they thought could give them the most help, I guess. So coming to Shiloh and worshiping God like this every year wasn't necessarily the norm, and yet Elkanah was doing this. So even though, we already looked at, he did have two wives, it seems like he was trying to fear God and worship him like God had asked them to. But obviously things were not going very well in the household department, and you can kind of imagine how messed up a situation like this would be. Here's two women probably both hoping to be the favorite of their shared husband, and one of them seems to be the favorite but can't have children, whereas the other one kind of seems to be a pretty awful person but didn't seem to have any problems with the baby department. So both have something up on each other, And of course, there's going to be tension there. And we might not fully understand just how important having children was at that time. At that point, having children meant having workers for your farm. And if you had daughters, it meant you could, in a sense, sell them to future brother-in-laws, because you got a pretty hefty, what do they call it, a dowry, that you would be paid for your daughter. So that was kind of future income, I guess. You could look at it that way. But it also meant passing on your family name, continuing and growing the tribes of Israel, not just your tribe, but you know the whole nation of Israel. And the women would have kind of seen it as their divine calling from God to, at least if they worship God, to continue to grow the nation of Israel. Like, that was kind of up to them. And so it specifically mentions that Peninnah would torment Hannah when they went to worship God in Shiloh. And I have to think that was for a reason. I can imagine that Peninnah was making a point that, in a sense, God was cursing Hannah for not allowing her to have children and fulfill what she was supposed to be doing. And she specifically does that when they go to worship God. So it's like an extra jab at the time when she would probably have been most sensitive to it, thinking about worshiping God like that. So I think it was Peninnah making a point that God had cursed Hannah, and that she could never do the most important thing that women were supposed to do, at least you know, at that time as they understood it. Now again, I don't know if what Elkanah said here when he was trying to comfort Hannah. Did you catch that at the, I think it was verse 8? I don't know if it came across the same way to Hannah as it does to us, but when I looked at that, I was like, you know, your wife is going through probably one of the most devastating things she can at that time, and Elkanah's way of cheering her up is saying, come on, you have me. I mean, I'm better than 10 sons, not? I know us guys can say some pretty insensitive things sometimes, but I think that kind of takes the cake. Anyway, at least we can give him credit for trying, and maybe that was extra at that point. I don't know. I think he might have been able to do it a little better than that, but let's read on through verse 20. This is kind of the rest of the story here. Once they had finished eating and drinking in Shiloh, Hannah stood up. Now Eli the priest was sitting on his chair by the doorpost of the Lord's house. In her deep anguish, Hannah prayed to the Lord, weeping bitterly. And she made a vow, saying, Lord Almighty, if you will only look on your servant's misery and remember me and not forget your servant, but give her a son, then I will give him to the Lord for all the days of his life, and no razor will ever be used on his head. And she kept praying. She kept on praying to the Lord. Eli observed her mouth. Hannah was praying in her heart, and her lips were moving, but her voice was not heard. Eli thought she was drunk and said to her, how long are you going to stay drunk? Put away your wine. Not so, my lord, Hannah replied. I am a woman who is deeply troubled. I have not been drinking wine or beer. I was pouring out my soul to the Lord. Do not take your servant for a wicked woman. I have been praying here out of my great anguish and grief. Eli answered, go in peace, and may the God of Israel grant you what you have asked of him. She said, may your servant find favor in your eyes. Then she went her way and ate something, and her face was no longer downcast. Early the next morning, they arose and worshipped before the Lord, and then went back to their home in Ramah. Elkanah made love to his wife Hannah, and the Lord remembered her. So, in the course of time, Hannah became pregnant and gave birth to a son. She named him Samuel, saying, because I asked the Lord for him. This is obviously a very familiar story, but there's one thing that jumped out to me that I guess I had never noticed before, and that is that everyone in this story got it wrong. Everyone except God. And maybe Hannah, I guess you could maybe make the point that she didn't. But, you know, Elkanah marries a second wife because he doesn't think Hannah can ever have children. And that causes a bunch of grief and turmoil. He tries to comfort Hannah, but he seems to completely miss the point there. Peninnah really gets it wrong. And even Eli, who's supposed to be the spiritual leader of all of Israel, completely misses it and thinks she's drunk. You know, if anyone that should have had wisdom in this situation and discernment and a sense of what was going on, it should have been him, and yet he completely misses it too. Maybe that tells us something about the state of Israel. You know, if that's what the first thing he thought, it probably was an indication that people were coming to the temple or to the tabernacle drunk. This probably wasn't the first time he'd seen that. And yet he still misses it when it was actually somebody that was troubled and praying. And yet, through the whole thing, God had a plan. And that points to that second point in our 3 points there. God had a plan to raise up Samuel, and he was using this kind of somewhat long and elaborate story here to raise up somebody that would lead to the many things, good things, that came out of this, you know, eventually leading to King David and then eventually to Jesus. But Samuel would go on to be a very faithful priest and prophet, and he would anoint kings and point them to God and point the people to God as well. And Hannah, you know, think about all the grief that she went through, and being probably, at least she thought of herself as, you know, despised or maybe even cursed by God. She goes on to become a hero for all of eternity. Think about, I can imagine that in heaven, we'll probably still think of this story, or maybe read it or recite it. So Hannah goes on to become a hero for all of eternity. The person who is the lowest in this story. And Peninnah, who thought she had it figured out and was tormenting Hannah, becomes the villain in this story and will be for all of eternity as well. Again, that first theme, that God will oppose the proud and raise up the humble. And that's why Hannah's prayer is so powerful and kind of captures these themes so well. I'll just read it. It's 1 Samuel 2, verses 1 through 10. It says, "Then Hannah prayed and said, 'My heart rejoices in the Lord. In the Lord my horn is lifted high. My mouth boasts over my enemies, for I delight in your deliverance. There is no one holy like the Lord. There is no one besides you. There is no rock like our God. Do not keep talking so proudly, or let your mouth speak such arrogance. For the Lord is a God who knows, and by him deeds are weighed. The bows of the warriors are broken, but those who stumbled are armed with strength. Those who were full hire themselves out for food, but those who were hungry are hungry no more. She who was barren has borne 7 children, but she who has had many sons pines away. The Lord brings death and makes alive. He brings down to the grave and raises up. The Lord sends poverty and wealth. He humbles and he exalts. He raises the poor from the dust and lifts the needy from the ash heap. He seats them with princes and has them inherit a throne of honor. For the foundations of the earth are the Lord's. On them he has set the world. He will guard the feet of his faithful servants, but the wicked will be silenced in the place of darkness. It is not by strength that one prevails. Those who oppose the Lord will be broken. The Most High will thunder from heaven. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed.'" And that last part there, "he will give strength to his king," that's pointing forward to that last point, that God will eventually send a future king. And so even in this prayer, she was prophesying. You know, we live in a time, just to wrap it up here, we live in a time when I think humility is often equated with weakness. saying you are wrong is almost unthinkable, especially if you're rich or powerful or, you know, have a lot of influence. But we'll see later in Samuel that admitting you were wrong and repenting are the only things that can keep someone from self-destructing. We see that later Saul did not do that. You know, when it was pointed out to him that he was wrong, he didn't repent, and he ends up committing suicide. Whereas David, when he sees his sin, he repented, and God redeemed that. But God will eventually deal with pride, and I think, we know that He's promised this over and over in Scripture, and that's scary because I think all of us know that we all deal with pride, at least at times. But I think it's also comforting too, because when we look around and see, we see prideful men doing some very wicked things, we wonder, like, why doesn't God judge that now? Why doesn't He bring justice now? And sometimes it seems like there is no justice. And think about all the war and suffering that's going on right now because of prideful men. But we do have a promise that God will deal with it. Sometimes it's not always on our time frame or as quickly as we'd like to see it. But there's a promise there that God will deal with that. But He also makes another promise, and this is also comforting. He says that He will exalt the humble. There are hundreds of thousands, probably, of Christians that are being persecuted and suffering for their faith. And yet there's a promise that God will exalt them at some point. It doesn't lessen the suffering that they're going through or that people that are suffering unjustly are going through. It doesn't lessen the suffering that you may be going through from something that you don't have any control over. But there's a promise that God gave that He will exalt you. He will exalt the humble. And so there's a warning there in that promise. If we're allowing ourselves to be lifted up instead of humbling ourselves before God, there's a warning that we will be brought down, but there's also a promise of God exalting us if we are humbled before Him. And that's, if there's one thing I want to leave with you, it's that first point, that God will always oppose the proud, and He will exalt the humble. Sometimes it's easy to think about that in terms of other people that we see, and less easy to think about the pride that's in my own life. And yet if that pride is unchecked, it will lead to our self-destruction. So I would just encourage you to think about that as we continue on with these stories and looking at these characters, and realize that through it all, God has a plan, and He will fulfill what He said He would do. I'll leave you with that. Thank you.